harping on the wars we fight, griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down for your life, I'm fighting and talking down to you. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me.
This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people, and of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. I'm going to play this week's episode of the Ethnostate with Bill Johnson and Ken Givens discussing many interesting current topics. The Ethnostate.
My mechanic is a tall, skinny Russian with blonde hair, blue eyes, and a very heavy accent. And one time, a couple of years ago, I guess, I had a Russian nationalist staying in our house, and I had to pick up my car from the repair shop. So I took him with me, and this Russian nationalist, I said, "Hey, my mechanic speaks Russian. So why don't you talk to him in Russian, tell him all about nationalism, white nationalism, what you're doing." So I get over there, and they talk a little bit in Russian, you know, and we get away, and I said, "Hey, what do you think?" He says, he wasn't impressed, he didn't care. But anyway, the reason why I say this is that, again, I had my car needing to be repaired, so one of my sons dropped me off at this gas station where the old Russian guy is there, and my son was letting me out to go get my car, and he says, "Oh, hey, there's Prager." And I said, "Who's Prager?" He says, "You know, Prager University." And I said, "Oh." So I looked over there, and so my son rolled down the window and says, "Hey, Mr. Prager, we're big fans of you. We watch da da da." And then it struck me that, yeah, that's Dennis Prager, who my wife likes to listen to on the radio. And I guess he's better known for what's called Prager University, which is, I guess, an internet, something what we're doing, can only on a much more successful scale. In any event, I went and I got my car, and I came out, and my son had just pulled away, and he was still getting gas. So I thought, well, I got to make some points with my wife. So I walked over to Mr. Prager, and I said, "Hey, my wife is a big fan of yours. She's tried to call in several times, but she's not been able to get through, and this is what she wants to say. She says that race matters, you can't ignore race, and you got to take that into consideration." So Prager looked at me, and he says, "You know, well, I hope your wife can get through next time." So that was very diplomatic. He didn't comment yes or no, but he just hoped the wife can get through. So I want all you guys listening that I'm at least getting the message out in gas stations when I can, telling someone who is, you know, is quite influential, and he has some views that are similar to ours, and eventually he may come around to realize that race is important.
Yeah, maybe. You know, Prager is Jewish. You probably knew that.
Yeah. But he still likes our people in many respects. And so, you know, at some point in time, he will come around and say some things, I think, that may help project our cause into a bigger sphere. The flip side of that little positive comment on race is what's taken place now in Washington, D.C. It just ended a couple of hours ago, I guess. Congress had a congressional hearing on hate, white supremacy, and white nationalism. And this went on for hours and hours. And the way that I found out about it is because I looked at the articles, and the article said that the hearing was covered live by Google, by YouTube, and in fact, at the congressional hearing, they asked Google and YouTube to testify and give their statements as to what they're doing to stop the spread of white nationalism and white supremacy. And so they were all saying how we got to cut down this evil of white nationalism. And some of them were saying, you know, we all support free speech, but we don't support hate speech. And then that reminded me of a meme that's going around. Someone says, well, I support physics, except gravity. You know, so if you're going to support free speech, you got to support all free speech. But in any event, they called all sorts of people to testify, and it was just really a hate fest but against white people. But the reason that made the article go around, it says that Facebook and Google had to shut down their comments section. And why do you think they had to shut it down, Ken?
People are being honest. Free speech.
It was an issue on free speech and white nationalism, and they had to shut it down because every one of the comments was promoting white nationalism. And so it was quite an enjoyable irony to listen to that.
Yeah, but they had to have a hearing. Says that white nationalists are making some significant headway. By the way, the article that I have on the screen says, in congressional hearing on hate, the haters got their way. Of course, haters means white nationalists. So right. Whoever wrote this, wire.com, which is, this is kind of a Prager type site. But they're saying that we got our way if they're using haters to be synonymous with white nationalists.
Do you know why that is? Because I guess the real person who won the argument was this woman you mentioned to us before we got on board. I didn't know who she was. She was like a black commentator, Candace somebody?
Candace Owens.
And what they say is that she got up there and she said, oh, the real haters are the Democrats. And she was going on, you know. And I thought, this is a real sad commentary on our people, where in order to defend white nationalists, we can't even have white people do it. It's got to be a black woman to get up there and defend our position. And that's why Wired said that we got our way. One, because Candace Owen did such a good job. And two, all the comments were so negative against the committee and so pro-white that they had to shut the comments down. And so what I did is I went to, after, you know, they shut it down for live streaming, but then they put it up afterwards on Google, and then they didn't disable the comments after it was posted on Google. And so I just took the first 50 or 100 comments, and you can see why we're gaining ground. And the first comment was, how long till YouTube removes this comment section like they did in the live stream? And then the next comment is, I love my people. No Israeli-owned parliament imbecile will ever take that from me. And then another comment says, if there would be a rise of white nationalism, there would be no such hearing. Why is there no hearing about the interests of a foreign country, which has been the most powerful lobby in the entire world? Why don't we have an open discussion about the rise of Zionism? Because these are the real issues we need to talk about. And then it goes on that this looks like a circus to make hate speech laws and to get rid of the First Amendment. Either you are a publisher or you're not. Sign up to dissenter.com. Okay. Then it says, the European ancestry, that'll be 16 months of jail and a charged felony along with a $500,000 fine. That goes to the nearest oppressed non-European ethnic family. The next comment is, remember that we're nice until we're not. And then it says, it's okay to be white. This hearing is a sham. Perfect example of a clown world. And it just goes on and on and on. And here's one that says, I am from India, and it's sad to see the West dying. They will come for the last year, only a matter of time. And then it just goes on and on. None of these are particularly nasty, but YouTube shut it down when it was live because they would say it's okay to be white, and that's not worth it. You know, you shouldn't comment on that.
Well, so, did anybody say anything in agreement with the? Before I say that, let me say this. Looking at this headline, where it says the congressional hearings on the 8th, the haters got their way. I think maybe what they're referring to are the Democrats. As I read through the article, they're saying, okay, the real haters are the Democrats.
Oh, I see.
When they got their way. So, anyhow, that's my point.
Okay. And then another guy says, it's okay to be white, it's okay to love your people, it's okay to want a nation to remain your nation. So, you know, these are good comments by normal people. So, you know, there is a movement and to combat all of this. So maybe we'll see a rise of, you know, of white nationalism beyond being suppressed by the establishment. Any other comments, Ken, on this point, on this issue?
Not really, other than if white nationalists were not having an impact, why would they be doing this? So It's kind of like an admission. The white nationalists are making some tremendous headway.
Yeah. But at what point in time will our white leaders come out and say, okay to be white? It's okay to be a white nationalist. I mean, you had Steve King, that congressman from Iowa, came out and do that, and they immediately came down and shut him down. They took away all of his committee assignments. And so, but it's a start. You know, we are so demoralized, so dejected, we have to rely on black women to be able to champion our cause. But eventually, you know, we'll be able to promote ourselves.
Yeah, I think the time is coming. To me, it's really encouraging. You know, if the enemy were not fighting you, then you're doing something wrong. It's when they ignore you, they don't recognize your existence, they have no argument or quarrel, that's when you lose. You don't fight with somebody who's not causing you trouble.
I know, but the enemy should not be our enemy. The enemy should be our ally. The enemy, all of these congressional leaders that are white, all the captains of industry, all the heads of universities, the administrators and the professors, there is just such a heavy hand against whiteness. You'd think that they would start to turn around and become our friends, but it's just oppressive. And I think I've said this before, all of these white people that are activists, that are Antifa, that are turning out and opposing us, at least they have our same heritage, our same ancestry, and there's a chance that we can convert them. And because they are zealous, they're activists, I feel more compassion and sympathy with them than the average white man who doesn't care, who just passively accepts the situation as it is. So I'm hopeful that we can start converting people en masse. We are converting a few. Maybe change will happen.
Something that I get out of this is that people are sensing that there is a cultural apocalypse. And it's coming. It's on our border. I mean, literally on our border.
Yeah.
And that people have to stop and think, hey, what's going to happen when, you know, white people are a minority in the United States? But
well,
it's
not
thinking that.
I mean, it's not just when we're a minority. It's when we are a vast, oppressed minority among 90% of a population that is not our own. But that brings up the next issue. The first one that you talked about is caravan-sized floods of immigrants arrive weekly. Let's talk about that article and the fallout from it.
One of the things that I noticed about the statistics is said that 76,000 illegal aliens, not their term, obviously, but 76,000 non-citizens crossed into the United States and were captured. That was in February, and in March they said the number will probably come in at around 100,000. And I'm thinking, you know, if this many people are being caught, how many more are coming in and not being caught? I'm guessing, I don't really know, but I'm just guessing, it's probably one for every 100, well, maybe one out of 10 gets caught. So if you have 100,000 that were being captured and taken into custody, what? Is there another 900,000 that's just walking across the border?
I read something about catch and release. Aren't they catching them and say appear for a hearing, and then they release them and they enter into whatever city they're nearest and start living the life and never report to court? It is truly an overwhelming situation. And maybe the good that comes out of that is that the flood is so large and so dramatic and so overwhelming that we have to take dramatic action. If it had just been a trickle like it's been since the 1960s and it continued on as a trickle and the ones that are here become citizens and have children, then it would be a slower replacement. So maybe an abrupt and swifter replacement will cause us to wake up and to react. We were talking with this South African person who appeared on our show, Simon Roach, I think it was, and he was really fearful of a civil war. And I commented to him, I said, well, why are you fearful of a civil war? Because that's when you can really have the change necessary. You need to have uprising to be able to make the corrections. He says, no, because we are so overwhelmed in numbers, we do not stand a chance. So if that type of situation occurs in America, where civil war happens when we still have enough numbers, then maybe we can combat it. But if it continues to decline at such a precipitous rate, we're going to become like South Africa, so overwhelmed that we can't do anything about it but die.
That is the exact direction that we are going. And to put this in context, I found a photograph of the Super Bowl this year. There was about 70,000 people who attended the Super Bowl.
Okay.
So if you stop and think, that many people, illegal aliens, are the ones who are being caught at the border every month. Well, that was the month of March. This month, or March rather, February was 70-some thousand, and March, they said, probably 100,000. April, probably be another 100,000. We have no idea. It's hard to conceptualize the invasion force. And I've said this many times, this is the same strategy that Gandhi used when he overwhelmed the authorities by sheer numbers of people. They are overwhelming the authority of the United States government just by numbers. They don't have to fire a shot.
Yeah.
Martin Luther King did the same thing.
See, when you have a people that are circumspect and conscientious about their family life, they plan to have a family, they wait till they can afford it, they get married, and they have a couple of children that they think that they can nurture and care for and rear to be good members of the society, that is a very powerful family unit, even though it's few in numbers. But when they the opposition just willy-nilly makes baby after baby after baby, and that person grows up hating white people, they get all of these social programs, they get all of this genetic welfare and Section 8 housing and education and all of that kind of stuff, that even though the cautious, hardworking family has maybe a better, producing a better quality child, they can't compete with the millions in numbers that overwhelm them. So it's truly dire.
Somebody in the chat groups wants your opinion. Who is behind the invasion? This guy says Soros. Who do you think?
Now, the people who are behind the invasion are the white people who have accepted this mischaracterization of what is good and what is right. And I remember I grew up in the 50s, and I went to school in the 50s and in the 60s. Well, of course, not much school. I went to school. I was in kindergarten for 3 months of the 50s. But I was a child of the 50s in school, at least, because I started it. And in the 60s. And as early as I can remember, there was this anti-white propaganda, but it wasn't anti-white so much, it was helping lift up the minorities. And I remember when we stopped calling them colored people and we started calling them minorities, I remember that was in the 60s, and I thought, oh, that's not going to last long because they're not always going to be minorities. But we had in our heart a misplaced altruism that we thought we wanted to help all of these people achieve the same level that the white people had. And that mentality has gripped every white person in America until this generation when we're finally waking up. So you hear all the time about people blaming Soros or people blaming the Jews. Those, and I think Soros is a Jew, but they mostly want to blame the Jews, but they have to blame themselves. The white man has to blame the white man because there's way more white people that are doing this than any other race. Of course, the blacks and the Hispanics and the Vietnamese that come in, they all want to have welfare and they all want to get ahead for their family. That's understandable. But the white person who is behind all of this is the one that is the most culpable. And that is the problem. And once we recognize and realize that, forget trying to come up with some sort of conspiracy theory of they are doing this, they are doing that. It's like Walt Kelly of Pogo says, and I think you've mentioned it several times, we have met the enemy and he is us. You know, that's exactly what it is. That's a takeoff of, was it Dewey when he was over in the Philippines when he says, we have met the enemy and he is ours. So it truly, the enemy is our own people. And what is heartening about these comment sections and all of these different articles is that the comments are by and large supporting of our position. So as we begin to change our mindset, our leaders will begin to follow, I hope.
I took a walk this afternoon, actually this morning, through our neighborhood. And I live in a middle-class white neighborhood, just kind of strolled around. Looking at people, you know, out taking care of their lawns and doing what they do. And I couldn't help but ask myself, how long is this going to last? Now, we have a few of non-white people in our neighborhood. They're good folks, the ones that I know, some of them good friends. But this neighborhood that we live in is going to be gone. I mean, there will come a time where, well, even Barack Obama, remember he wanted to have every zip code integrated, and if a municipality or any jurisdiction didn't do that, they would lose federal funding, kind of like Trump is doing to Central American countries. If you don't stop, we're going to quit sending you money. Well, Barack Obama was going to do that to us because our neighborhoods were not integrated. Somehow we got to get that in our head that being pro-white is not anti-black or anti-East Asian or anti-Hispanic. We're just protecting the goose that lays the golden egg, which everybody benefits from that gold. And if you fry the goose, you know, there's nothing left.
Well, Barack Obama didn't have to do that because it is a natural occurrence. Everybody around the entire world want to live around white people. They want to live in white communities. They want to come into white countries. The entire world is made up of white supremacists. They think that the whites are the best people and they want to come in and be our neighbor. I mean, I don't know how many times I have seen people come in from overseas and they'll say, oh, I didn't know there were so many non-whites here. Or people have moved here and says, you know, I came to America because I want to live around white people. And they are disappointed, they are dejected that they can't have that experience because so many of like-minded people want the exact same thing. So every community, every school, every town, what is it that Longfellow said, every village, Sussex and town or whatever it is going to have that same composition. Mixture of whites and non-whites until the whites are completely eradicated from every white country.
And we're seeing it happen before our very eyes. You know, there is literally no place in Sweden that is not forcibly being integrated. To my knowledge, even these tiny little islands, you know, that surround the Nordic countries, they are importing people from the Middle East. Same thing is true of England. There are some areas in England that were at one time, you know, like islands. Some of them are economically depressed. They cannot support these people. But still, they send them there. It's hard to believe it's not by design. Somebody in the chat group asked you another question. Where's the money coming from? Who is funding the caravans?
Well,
I think it's the same question. They're just framing it a little bit differently.
Well, what has happened is that it's made the news, and so everybody thinks, oh, I can come to America. And it's not just Central or South America. The Cubans are reading the news, and they're saying, hey, if these people from Nicaragua can come to America, I can come too, as well. So the Cubans are now creating caravans to come over, or flotillas, or whatever it is. So it is an organic development caused by the largesse of the white countries everywhere. See, America is still able to print fiat currency and pay for everything because they just print money and the money still has value. So we can absorb and absorb and absorb all of these people that are acting on their own. You give way too much credit to the they of this world if you think that they can orchestrate so magnificently this dispossession.
Well, and it's kind of like being a they supremacist. They are supreme. They are superior. Because they are doing it to us.
It is an organic development that because we have this concept that started to battle the Jim Crow laws, and it started way before the Jim Crow era, and it started way before the Civil War. I mean, the concept is that at the bottom of every lending application, every employment application, it always says that we are an equal opportunity lender, we are an equal opportunity employer. And the concept has always been to help bring these people up. And so much so that if that coupled with the fact that white people don't get married. Every one of these listeners, how many of you are married and have kids? I mean, take a look. I look at my mother and I look at my father. My mother came from a family of 14 kids or something like that. A lot of them died in childbirth, you know, at a very young age because, you know, and also the influenza of 1918. But my father came from about 10 or 11 kids. There were a lot of kids in that generation. And now, you know, we don't have that many. My wife and I have five kids, and my wife came from a family of eight children. But that's unusual. Our five children is unusual, but it would have been a small family a couple of generations ago. So how many of you listening to my voice, and unfortunately not very many, how many of you are married and how many of you have kids? So put down the, find a gal, marry her and start having kids and raring them to be good citizens of the community. That's what it's going to take. And then after a generation or two, maybe the remnant of white people can wake up and throw off the blindness that cover our own eyes, and we'll have a future. I'm sorry for that soapbox.
No, that's no problem. Some of the people in the chat group are women, by the way. So,
well, the women. You know, you need to track these guys. I don't blame the women. I blame the guys. It's these guys that aren't getting married. It's never happened before in the history of the world. And I think it's pornography that keeps them from getting married and having a family. So, you know.
Yeah, that's a whole different topic. But I just never got into why guys get into that stuff. You know, what kind of an idiot goes to a strip club? I mean, how stupid, how drunk can you be to sit there and give money to people? Anyhow, that's a stupid topic. But let me ask you this. Let's project 50 years from today. This is, let's say, the year 2070. If nothing changes, if we keep going the same direction, Bill, that we're going now, what will America look like? What will Australia look like? What will Western Europe look like?
Well, first of all, in 50 years, I intend to be winding down my practice of law. So I'll be getting ready to retire. And well, you know, there is that barber somewhere in New Jersey is still cutting hair at 108. So, you know, it's possible, you know. But in any event, in 50 years, you know, it's often said, and I've quoted this off, that we know what happened in the past, we know what's happening today, but we don't know what will happen in the future. And I think I perceive there to be two scenarios. One is the most, I guess, negative one that a lot of people are saying, that, oh, it's too late to reverse the trend. The white race will die out, and there will only be maybe a very small people left, small number of white people left in 50 years. And then it'll be, you know, they'll be hunted and hounded and hurt. But the other side is more optimistic, that we will wake up, we will rise up, we will realize the importance of the whites, we will realize the importance of this world, and we will take dramatic action and to save our people and to save this world. And it won't be like Stephen Hawking says, or what Elon Musk says, or some of the others. We won't be going to another planet, which those guys think is an easier solution than correcting our problems here. I think we may wake up, we will embrace eugenics, we will stop physically the reproduction of all of these African peoples in Africa. Where the projection is that there are going to be 30 billion Africans, and they're all going to be coming here. We will wake up, we will stop them from reproducing, just like the Chinese stopped its own people from having kids. But instead, the Chinese had one child per family, we will allow them to have one child per 50 families. And then we will get control of the world, we'll have a balance again, and the white people will wake up and move forward. That is the demographic issue. What's going to happen with the social issues? I believe that in 50 years, Christianity will still continue to decline. Religion will still continue to decline. The Muslim religion will be checked, because we will not allow them, for eugenics purposes, to continue their rampant growth and acceleration. And so that I believe that there will be a diminution in religious belief, more so than it is now, but there will be a rise of a different social concept that will replace religion. Then I believe in economics, that capitalism will be replaced by kind of distributism, or something where on a local level where we want to support our own people. I believe that the that we will no longer have these large, massive governments, or countries with one big government. It will kind of devolve into much smaller units, maybe city-states again, and there will be not democracy, or certainly not the one-man, one-vote democracy. It may be another system. That's my prognostication.
One of the women in the chat group has this question. It is, why should men marry when there are women out there giving the milk away to all?
That's what they say. You know, why buy the cow when you get the milk for free? Yeah. And that's what. But that is placing the blame on the women, and I don't think we should do that. The blame should be placed on the man, because it is the man who has relinquished his righteous dominion over his household, and he has fallen to be able to embrace the carnal nature. So it is the man that needs to take a leading role again and to promote a good family life. But that doesn't mean that I believe that polygamy can be a system that is can be embraced in the white community. Of course, my wife would never accept that. I would never do it. But I believe that might be something that will gain traction. Right now we have serial polygamy, or we have nightly polygamy among the men, and we've got to stop that arrangement. I think that the men need to value the family, value the wife and the children. And if in order to satisfy his carnal urges, he needs to have more than one wife, and if a woman can accept that, then I think that might be a solution. But this just willy-nilly waste your life in strip clubs or pornography or going to serially with different women, that's got to stop, and it's up to the men to change the direction.
If one defines polygamy as having multiple partners at the same time, then I know a lot of fundamentalist Baptist preachers who are polygamists. I mean, they wind up getting fired when they get caught. But, yeah, they're polygamists.
I think that there needs to be a eugenics. I believe that there needs to be a new high standard of morality that doesn't necessarily have to be tied to religion. I mean, I've attended church my whole life, and I will attend church my whole life, and I brought my kids up that way. But I believe that there are other ways to instill a high form of morality that is divorced from religion. But we need to have a high form of morality again. But that immorality, in my opinion, could embrace polygamy. I do think that we need to also value our children, our offspring, and we want to have the best for them. We want to have what's best for our children and for our wives, and not what's best for ourselves. That is what we need to achieve in this life. So, all right.
Now I'm just kind of reading the chat group to see what kind of response we're getting.
Okay.
And Stardust, this is the same woman who spoke before, says, 10, I need more than one husband. That would be crazy. I have no idea what she means.
Well, okay, she's saying the same thing. When I've been married for 40 years, and in those 40 years, on maybe two or three occasions, like maybe once every 10 years, I will broach the subject with my wife very carefully. I say, hey, you know, I think polygamy might be a way to go to save the white race. So then after she calms down and stops beating on me, then she will use that same argument. Well, then I want to have more than one husband, and I think that's called polyandry. So you make that argument. I think that that the men have more of a sexual drive than women do. Women have more of a desire of nurturing and rearing the family. So in that sense, I think that polygamy can work. But you know, I know that I'm going to be held my feet to the fire for this comment by my wife and by others. But you know, I think that is something that could be considered. Not by me. I mean, I'm very happy. I've been faithful to my wife, and my wife has been faithful to me, and we have a very good marriage, and we've taught our children to be the same way. That notwithstanding, I believe that the concept is something that could be considered among certain elements, certain segments of society. A willing man, which is not hard to find, and willing women, which would be harder to find to participate in that arrangement.
Okay.
Well, if we've exhausted that topic, let's move out of that hot water topic and let's go to the next one.
Yeah, I was hoping you'd change topics.
What?
I got more stuff to say on that, but I'm not going to say it.
Well, no, why don't you go ahead and say it? Yeah, why don't you say it? I'd like to hear that.
Well, yeah, we can delve into it a little bit, but one of the things that I notice is that virtually every culture outside of Western culture has embraced polygamy. The Old Testament, you know, King Solomon, well, just name any of the patriarchs. As far as I know, they were all polygamists. Some of them may not have been, I don't know. But it was accepted. That was a part of Judaism, part of their culture, even before it was Judaism. Well, when did it change? You know, when you read the New Testament, it says, for example, a pastor must be the husband of one wife. You can only have one wife, at least one wife at a time. Something influenced us that this Christianity being an offspring of Judaism to do away with polygamy, which at one time was perfectly acceptable in every culture on the planet. But let me make a point real quick, and I think that influence was, I see Christianity as emerging out of Middle Eastern culture and Western culture. And from Western culture, from the Greeks and the Romans, who by and large did not practice polygamy, I think that's where they got that moral perception. I think monogamy is a Western concept.
Okay, I think more than attributing it to Greek and Romans, I think you can attribute it to the Teutonics, the Goths, the Northern Europeans, because I have read, I think, Tacitus or these other Roman writers who wrote about our ancestors from Gaul, which is your ancestors, or from the British Isles, which is mine, where they said that the Germanic peoples there, they were faithful to their wives and they only had one wife. So I think that's true, and I think that's a good point.
Just incidentally, my ancestry is British Irish, but my name is French.
Okay.
But I can trace back my ancestors; they're primarily Western Europeans.
Okay. Yeah. All right. But so in any event, there is a baseness now that Western man has embraced that is causing our destruction. And my wife will talk about it all the time, is that we are no longer a moral people, and that's precipitating our decline. But I want to add that my great-grandfather, and before that the great-great-grandfather and great-great-grandfather, and my wife's great-grandfather and great-grandfather, they were all polygamous. So, you know, we both come from polygamous families, and we pretty much know how that worked out. But it only lasted for, like, I think, three generations until, I think it was Wilford Woodruff. He banned it, and then Mitt Romney's ancestors had to go to Mexico, and mine had to go that same area, too. We were on the busy side, the side of Mexico. But in any event, okay, so let's go on to another topic. Let's talk about the Cory Booker presses for slavery reparations. What is that all about?
Well, here's what I think it's all about. I think it's about the Democrats wanting to bind the black vote to the Democratic Party. And one issue that black people love, they cling to, is this idea of reparations. So what Cory Booker is doing is this, according to WashingtonTimes.com. Cory Booker announced a bill Monday to form a commission to recommend reparations for slavery, taking the reins of one of the most intriguing and controversial agenda items from the 2020 campaign. Well, it says that Mr. Booker becomes the highest profile lawmaker to sign on to reparations legislation, saying it could solve persistent racism and discrimination. No, it's not, but that's what he says, you know, please will. That have been built into the system for decades, leading to a desperate outcomes for all black Americans. They love that word, disparate. I don't know why disparate this, disparate that, disparate outcomes. But that's not what this is about. You know, you get black people reparations and nothing will change. It's like electing a black president.
Okay, my wife has a driver and she is as conservative as my wife and me. She's just as conservative as my wife and I are. But so in any event, she just talks all about these political things and very, very racially conscious. And she told my wife that yesterday, Dennis Prager had a talk show on reparations, this very issue. And my wife's driver got through. And she said that, yeah, I got through and I talked to Dennis Prager about it. And my wife says, oh, great. She says, yeah. And I said, I think they should get reparations. And so my wife said, what? You know, she said, yeah, I think they should get reparations. I think we all need to get, you know, and so this is the craziest thing. And you have someone that's kind of on boat.co, which I watch a lot. His name is Patrick Little. And he's going around doing YouTube things. And he said, yeah, I think we should get black reparations. So there is some sort of crazy element in our movement. Well, actually, most of our movement is crazy. But there is a specifically crazy element in our movement that is supporting of reparations for blacks. And that's just beyond me. Because first of all, they already get more than they ever need. In fact, We need to stop giving them so much. We need to make them pay for their education, pay for the food. I mean, nowadays, they come to school early. It's not just the blacks, but Hispanics, all, you know, all of these people. They come to school early, they get breakfast, they get lunch, and now the schools are packaging take-home food for them to have dinner. So we're giving them three meals a day. The parents drop them off early in the morning, and they pick them up after, you know, at dinner time, or because they have free daycare for all these people. It is just so bizarre how much reparations we give these people already. And somebody put on a meme on the internet that says about reparations. It says, why should I, who never have slaves, give reparations to a black man who was never a slave? You know, it just doesn't make sense. We give way too much.
If you look at Cory Booker, it is obvious from his appearance this guy has white ancestry. So does he get like a percentage of his 40 acres of the deal?
If you're 10% black, you're 100% black. So he's entitled just as much as Obama's dad that stepped off the boat.
What would happen if, let's say that this legislation had been passed, I don't know, a year or two ago, and today was the day, that reparations were paid, billions of dollars deposited in the bank accounts of every black person in America? What impact would that have on our economy? What I think is this, think about it, spend it. You know, I think you would invest in GM. Because they would start selling Escalades hand over fist. But I think they would take the money and just dump it back into the economy. Well, some of it going to drugs. But, you know, that underground economy, they go back.
That massive amount of money, it would cause a severe devaluation of the dollar, and inflation would ramp, and our currency would be similar to Venezuelan currency. But one thing is, we did give reparations on a smaller scale to the Japanese who were incarcerated during World War II in Manzanar and these other incarceration places. We did give them a modest amount of reparations, and it was interesting. A lot of the Japanese said, no, we shouldn't get reparations. Of course, they didn't turn down the check, but, you know, in principle, they thought that, no, it's not appropriate. And, of course, some of them, of course, were uprooted, but some of them had better lives afterwards. I mean, I talked to many of them that said, oh, yeah, I enjoyed Manzanar. I was able to go there and mingle with all of our my people. We were able to study, and I met my wife there, and we got married and kept our families. It was a good place. So, but, you won't hear that kind of positive comments coming from the great, 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 great grandchildren of slaves, because to them they're still feeling the repercussions of it, and they just want money. But yeah, it's not doable. It's not workable. It shouldn't happen. In fact, it needs to go the other way. We need to take away every single entitlement from everybody. And if they want to get food stamps, they have to be sterilized. If they want to send their kids to the hospital, they got to get sterilized first. We got to terminate this free education. The California Constitution says we have to educate every child. Well, that needs to stop, because these people are uneducatable. What we need to do is to comply with that California designation, and the constitutions of many states have that same requirement. You need to put coursework online and say, here you go, kids. You know, education. We're going to have classroom study through the second grade. From third grade on, you're on your own. Study online. That's our. And then those that want to learn can. Those that can't won't be babysat for 14 years in the classroom.
But then we'll have to buy them computers and pay for their internet. Starbust is on a roll tonight. She said, I'm not giving them any of my IQ. I think that's a good point. They can take our money, but they can't take our
money. Somebody gave Cory Booker part of her and his IQ.
Yeah.
You know, that's got to stop. You know, but that's, I think, indefensible. We need to husband our heritage and keep it within our own people. Because it will be those that are of mixed race that will be the most destructive for our people.
Well, let me ask you this. Why is it that we see that that is, as a culture, that to the zeitgeist that permeates our thinking has convinced us that it is so, so very wrong to selectively group people? Why is that immoral? We were talking earlier that you can have morality without religion. Well, this is their morality, that eugenics is discredited science. I've heard that a zillion times. But is why do people think it's immoral?
It's an extension of the concept of anti-racism. If you are truly non-racist, then you are happy to have your child to be mixed race. You're happy to, and then the same thing, you have this George Lucas, who had Star Wars. He married a black woman almost beyond childbearing age or whatever it is, so they had in vitro fertilization to have black children, because he wanted to prove that he is not racist. And so it is an extension of racism. If you want to have your children look like yourself, then you're racist. And that is a throwback of that old movie. I stopped watching movies, probably in the 1970s. But there was a movie before that with Elizabeth Taylor, Rock Hudson, and James Dean. And it was called Giant. And it was about a Texas farmer or rancher who had owned millions and millions of acres in Texas. It was one of the smaller ranches. But in any event, he had a son, James Dean, and Dean's son was going to marry a Mexican gal. And Rock Hudson's comment was, I always thought my grandchildren would look like me. And so that was, of course, Rock Hudson, he's certainly not a good representative of a white race, but the concept, the person who wrote that script, lamented the fact that James Dean's children were going to be Mexican. And nowadays, if we want to have our own white children, we're looking at being racist. You have that Charlize Theron or whatever he is, she's from, I think, South Africa. There's a photo going around where she's peddling two little black kids in a stroller. I don't know whether they're her own or they're adopted. But that is a concept nowadays. You raise other racist children if you're white. If you want to raise your own children, you're racist. That is the most destructive attitude that's killing our people.
Good answer.
Okay. All right. So then let's move on to another topic. We don't have much time here. Let's see. Teacher prohibits student from picking Trump as the class project hero. Tell us what that's all about.
Well, apparently there was a school that had a class project, and I'm guessing it's a little bit of history, a little bit of creative writing, but the assignment was select somebody that you think is a hero to you, and write about him. Do some research, write about him. And this little girl did that. But she chose Donald Trump, and the teacher was nonplussed. And let me scroll down here. It says a Lake Run, comma mother. That's a town, I guess, somewhere. I think it's in New York, if I remember correctly. Claims her daughter was not allowed to have President Donald Trump as her hero for a class assignment. When the sixth graders at Somerset Middle School were assigned to pick a hero on whom they would write a report, the 11-year-old said her choice was a no-brainer. Donald Trump is my hero. So it goes on and it says that her teacher said that Trump, and this is a quote, spreads negativity and says bad stuff about women in front of another teacher and students in the class. The teacher told her to pick another hero. So Donald Trump is a bad guy.
I think that the teacher's comment underscores a larger problem or a larger issue than just the fact that this woman did not like Donald Trump. Donald Trump, for better or for worse, has become a lightning rod for opposition and division. There are a lot of things in his life that people have focused in on, the media, the Democrats, the left-wing, and even the never-Trumper Republicans, that make him a controversial figure. So even if this teacher were pro-Trump, I could see her saying, don't pick Donald Trump because he is a divisive figure, even though he's president of the United States. I'm not saying this to rehabilitate the comments of the teacher, but I think that it underscores a larger problem in that we have demonized Donald Trump so much in society that an administrator or a teacher is truly facing a dilemma that she doesn't want controversy in her classroom, so she says, pick another individual. And she said, well, why don't you do a Barack Obama? So I think it's crazy how the white people are so demoralized that we won't object to that Obama is not controversial, but Donald Trump is.
I'm not sure this is working anymore. This idea that Donald Trump is a racist, it's kind of like people just brush it off. They have played that card so often that, you know, it's almost counterproductive. It almost mobilizes the thinking of sane people to become scrutinizing in the way they perceive the far left's propaganda. This is an example. I think the more they do dumb stuff like this, it used to work. I remember we all felt guilty. We felt bad. Well, I didn't. A lot of people did. And I'm not sure that it's not working in our favor nowadays. The more they do this, the more it helps us. What do you think?
Well, okay, I also think that public opinion plays a very big role. Like, if, for example, some old guy was living in England and he was knighted by the Queen for services, whatever, and becomes Sir, you know, King Gibbon or whatever it is, he would be proud of that designation. But if that same person had been knighted during Hitler's Germany, he would be ashamed of that. He would hide that because of the perception of society. And so you have a lot of people who are pleased to have served in the Bush administration, in the Clinton administration. They'll say, oh yes, I was undersecretary for this and that under Clinton. But a lot of people are ashamed and don't want to serve under Clinton, under Trump, because of the bad reputation, the bad rap that he has gotten in the press. So it extends beyond just calling Donald Trump a racist. It's the entire administration has been under such ferocious attack by so many institutions that people are afraid, are ashamed, and don't want to be associated with what is a very powerful administration.
Well, let me ask you this question, what comes to mind. A lot of people on the left are portraying Donald Trump as almost like a cult leader, cult figure, where he's almost idolized and worshipped, not quite, but very charismatic, very persuasive, has a very loyal audience. And I can actually see that. But I can also see it with Barack Obama, that he's almost a demigod in the eyes of people on the left. And having said that, I got to say that in my lifetime, I've never seen another president so revered to the place where they almost deify him. You know, they didn't do that to the Bushes. They sure didn't do it to Clinton. They didn't do it to Richard Nixon. We know that. Not even Eisenhower with his general status. I cannot think of a single president in my lifetime that was so revered as has been Donald Trump and Barack Obama.
I disagree with you. I believe it is not a cult. It is not a personality. It is purely a political feeling. People like Barack Obama, not because of who he is, not for his personality, not for his big ears, or whatever. They like him because he was a personification of what they wanted to achieve politically. They wanted a black